the Mountain Broadcast Center. This is Take Two. Me, Martinez. We know, Thanksgiving was yesterday, and right now you might be battling deal-hungry shoppers, but that is probably actually making you hungry, as in you need to eat food now. Well, that's where we come in, because for the next hour, we're going to shower you with tasty options, such as LA's hottest soul food with a slice of Oaxacan cuisine and culture. It's all coming up when Take Two kicks off in just a few. Keep your ears and tummies here. From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I'm Martinez. Thanks for joining us on this Friday after Thanksgiving. Hope you all had a great one. The Take Two team is thankful to have the day off today, but we leave you with a special show all about food. Assuming your appetite has returned after eating your fill of turkey yesterday, we aim to tantalize your taste buds with some features from our archives, one digging into local soul food in L.A.
So what we have in front of us, crispy turkey meatloaf burger. This was a surprise item. Fresh house-made meatloaf, Japanese breadcrumb, shaved apples, red cabbage, slaw. It looks amazing. Texas toast to go on
Texas
top of
toast.
It. So anything
that's in between Texas toast, you know it's going to be banging.
And another story about the history of the city's oldest steakhouse, Musso and Frank.
And so Hollywood and Musso's really truly did grow up together. And when you talk about history of one or the other, it's really symbiotic.
All that deliciousness coming up in about 30 minutes. But first, we want to bring you a conversation we had a few months ago about Oaxacan food and the special relationship between California and that Mexican state. The connection is so deep that there is a thing, if you will, called Oaxaca, California. Call it a state of being, a movement, or just something that defines the many indigenous people who've come from Oaxaca to live, work, and contribute to the Golden State. In Los Angeles alone, there are some 200,000 people from Oaxaca living here, with many settling in neighborhoods in Koreatown and West LA near Palms and Mar Vista. You've probably noticed the many restaurants offering mole smothered tortillas, barbacoas, chilaquiles that can all be washed down with mezcal, that smoky agave-based spirit that's become so popular here. Now, because of all that, we brought a group together in for an in-person event back in October to talk about Oaxaca, California and its influence in Los Angeles. Here is part of that conversation.
Who likes to eat Oaxacan cuisine? Everybody, of course, everyone on stage as well. So that's what we're going to talk about for the next half hour or so. So we're going to introduce our panel. Right to my right is Elena Shatkin. She is the food editor for LAist.
Hi there.
To her right is Javier Cabral. He's the editor of LA Taco. Also has a book coming out. Congratulations, Javier. The book is called Oaxaca, Home Cooking from the Heart of Mexico. So thanks for being here and congratulations on your book.
Thank you. What's up, everyone?
And to his right, Odilia Romero and Alfonso Martinez. She reps the Binational Front of Indigenous Organizations, and together they run a pop-up called Panchos Tlayudas in South LA. Odilia, Alfonso, thanks for coming out.
Hi, Padiu.
What did you say?
Just for thank you to inviting us here to talk about Oaxacan food.
Oh, awesome. Well,
thank
good,
you
good.
For
thank
coming you. To talk about it.
Yeah, and
you're the one who gets the thank you.
I'm from Santo Domingo Albarradas, La Colula, Oaxaca. When you go to Oaxaca, just Google it and I think.
Can we drop your names over there
yes.
in case?
Will doors open for us? Will we get magical, you know, entrees?
Mezcal will pour from the sky.
Yes.
So let's start off with a term that might be new to a lot of people, Oaxaca, California. Okay, so Javier, what is that term?
Oaxaca, California is an amalgamation of Oaxaca and California. And as it was noted by here, is there aren't many other Mexican states that demand the hybridization of two states like these two. And it's because, I mean, Oaxaca is really a driving force in cuisine, culture in Southern California and even the Central Valley and Northern California too. How would you define it?
Well, Oaxaca, California is more of a political statement of indigenous people. And for me, like Oaxaca, California is the people living under the trees producing our food in La Jolla, the people in Greenfield picking our lettuce, the people in Fresno pruning our grapes, and the people also that are cooking our food, packing our food, harvesting the food, that are able to go back home too. that are able to speak their language. Oaxaca, California, for me, is those children that are born here that continue to speak the language, that prepare for a ceremonial dance, that go back home to celebrate in with the patrons and going back home. So it's more than the trendy food in L.A.
Alfonso, what about you?
It's Oaxaca in California. And when I came to L.A., I started to work at UCLA. There's many Oaxacans working at the cafeteria. I worked there for 3 years. And then I went to work another restaurant. So many workers come from Oaxaca. They say, hey, eres de Albarradas. I say, yeah, I'm from Albarradas. Yeah, I know you. I saw you playing music because I'm a musician too. That's why I worked different restaurants. I saw many people work there from Oaxaca. And then they say, hey, do you miss Oaxaca? Do you extrañas Oaxaca? I say, no. I have everything here. We have food, we have music, we're practicing our language, we're practicing las costumbres, our tradition. So we have everything.
So you're connected even though you're not there.
Yeah.
Well, you mentioned the language, and that was actually something I wanted to ask you about, Odelia, because I don't know if a lot of people here know, but you run the Binational Front of Indigenous Organizations, where you work as a liaison and a translator for indigenous communities here. So when you talk about the language, you're not necessarily talking about Spanish. You help people who speak Mixtec, other languages. They need interpreters, and oftentimes, you know, police officers, people in social services, or just other situations assume that Spanish, but that's actually not the language that a lot of immigrants necessarily speak when they come here from Oaxaca.
Well, the FIOB, I'm going to call it for short, the FIOB, the Binational Front of Indigenous Organization. We are a human rights organization, and we do a lot of advocacy for indigenous people's rights because, yes, not every Mexican speaks Spanish. In Mexico, there is 68 indigenous language families. In Oaxaca, there are 16 languages of families. Alfonso speaks Zapotec, I speak Zapotec, but we could never have a conversation because that's how diverse it is.
Because it can be very specific, not even just the region, but from village to village, as I understand.
Right. I am from the Sierra Norte. He's from Central Valleys, and we cannot have a conversation. I mean, we can argue in Zapotec. We can argue in English. And the thing that we argue about is the guajillo. He loves to cook with guajillo. I don't like the chile guajillo, you know? But
I wouldn't mind hearing the food argument, though, just be there to hear it. And then taste the food?
He loves to cook with guajillo.
Guajillo, sorry.
Why? Why do you love it?
I love the color. If you make your salsa with guajillo, it looks great. And then another secret.
That is true.
It's so delicious. No.
And pasilla?
No.
He's a guajillo. Break the tie, Javier. Which is better?
Okay, so for Oaxaca, for the cookbook, you know, I was introduced to pasilla oaxaqueño, which is a different pasilla from the rest of Mexico that I think slightly smoked. And it's a brighter flavor. It's a smokier flavor. And for me, that's like when you talk about Oaxaca and Oaxacan food, pasilla, for the most part, is the main chile that is used.
Right. In my region, we don't use pasilla that often. If anything, we use a lot of tomatoes to color the food. And also guajillo is used. And there is a chili. I don't know. It's Spanish, but it's a very small chili that is very spicy, but it also gives colors. In Poncho's region,
we plant chilies. Like chile guajillo too, and we dry it. We have wild chili, and then that's why we don't use more like serranos. No, we plant our chilies.
Well, I understand too that from your region, the Sierra Norte region, Odelia, the food is a lot more vegan.
It is very plant-based, our food, like corn and beans or amarillo guindao with mushrooms. So there's a lot of things that don't have onions, that don't have garlic, besides the tomato sauce, and it's very plant-based.
We don't know what they call them vegan. It's just beans and that's it.
That's just normal for you. Yeah. That's not anything special.
When I came here, when I started to cook, I said, do you have vegan? I said, I don't know. What are you talking about, right? Yeah, it's just beans. It's just chili.
Yeah, and that's why I think that people have recently just fell so much in love with Oaxaca and comida oaxaqueña, Oaxacan food. You know, if you, chances are, you know, if you're visiting Mexico, you're either going to go to Mexico City, Tulum, or Oaxaca. And if you go to Oaxaca, you go there for the food, you go there for the mezcal, for the beautiful just environment and the friendly people. But besides that, like Oaxacan food is so, it depends so much on the layering of flavors, on sazon. And there's different ways of doing it. You know, you have so many wild herbs that you don't really find anywhere else in Mexico. Different beans and different like dried fish, and it's just it's one of the states and regional styles in Mexico that has maintained their tradition since before the conquest.
I'm curious, why do you think Oaxacan food has managed within Mexico stay so true to its roots? Do you think it's partly the geography, that Oaxaca is sort of, you know, toward the southern part of the country and kind of a rugged area that's a little harder to get to than some other areas?
I will highlight one moment that I had when I was in Oaxaca City, and it kind of made me realize, it gave me perspective on, you know, the pride of being Oaxacano. I was in a little shop, and they were selling a little bag of chile. It was a paste of chile. I think it was a chile pasilla, a Oaxacano, and it was made by the Mijes. And the Mijes, their tagline is, or like the way they're known, is Los Jamás Conquistados, which means like the never conquered. So it's there in quotes underneath like the product name. It's an indigenous product. So in my experience when interviewing Los Lópezes, which is what Oaxaca is about, the book that I wrote, is that because of the rugged terrain, the conquistadors, they did not make it up there. I mean, Odilia, what do you have to say about that?
Well, I think it's been the exclusion of the state, right? Like, and not providing, we're like far south. And as many of you might know, Oaxaca, Guerrero, and Chiapas are the poorest state economically in the Mexican Republic, or a lot of the indigenous nations. We could say Chihuahua in the north. But I think there, Oaxaca has un alma rebelde. It has a rebel soul, right? All the movements, all political movements, uprising have happened in Oaxaca. And we have been very proud to say, no, we are not going to assimilate. And even when we get here, we don't fully assimilate. We integrate, we learn the language. We go to the Dodger game, we go to a basketball game, you know? But we still speak our language, we still eat our food, we still dance our traditional dances, our ceremonial dances. So I think that is what makes us very different, and that allows us to continue our traditions and back home and here.
Now, you two run a pop-up, Panchos Tlayudas, which would be awesome at Dodger Stadium. So if you want to write a letter or send something to the Dodgers, that would be awesome. But tell us what you serve there. And first off, what is a tlayuda?
A tlayuda? Want to explain it, please? The master?
I have a tlayuda. Tlayuda's big, big, big thin corn tortilla. We prepare it with unrefined lard, black beans, quesillo from Oaxaca, cabbage, and then if you decide... eat it with chorizo, tasajo, of course, black sausage. We make black sausage. The black sausage, Odilia's family, they made it for more than 40 years in LA. When I met her, we talked about the black sausage, and then I decided to work with her dad, with families, and until today. That's why I said our tlayuda is unique.
You know, and I will say that it's really interesting because, you know, I've studied, researched all regional Mexican styles, and there are very few cultures or regional cultures within Mexico that, like you said, refuses to give up their traditions, you know. So in Oaxacan food in L.A., you still find tlayudas made from, like, heirloom corn. And it's not, like, they've been doing it since before, like, not being GMO or organic was cool. Like, that's just the way they
since
are.
Before artisanal.
Before the word artisanal, yeah. And, yeah. Like, they've been doing, I mean, Oaxacanos have been bringing, like, their products to L.A. since the late 80s, early 90s. Like, so instead of giving in and, like, you know, eating, like, these, like, dry, like, old pinto beans, no, they would bring their own beans from Oaxaca. The most important one that I think is the most interesting and delicious one is, instead of giving in and buying or using, you know, sad, rubbery American cheese, or like queso Oaxaca, they bring quesillo from Oaxaca. And there's a huge underground quesillo market. It's all about that sells unpasteurized cheese, that it's really briny, squeaky, like European or Mexican cheeses. So that's why Oaxaca just demands the respect from, at least in the food world, because it's delicious.
That was Javier Cabral, editor of LA Taco and co-author of the new cookbook, Oaxaca, Home Cooking from the Heart of Mexico, LA's food editor, Elena Shatkin, plus husband and wife team, Odilia Romero and Alfonso Martinez. She runs the nonprofit migrant group, the Binational Front of Indigenous Organizations in South LA. He operates the pop-up eatery, Ponchos Tlayudas, just behind her office. And as you'll also hear coming up when we continue our conversation, you can also find Alfonso and his food every Sunday at the outdoor food market Smorgasbord just east of downtown. We'll be back with him, Odilia, Javier, and Elena in just 1 minute. Back now with Take Two from 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. We've been talking about Oaxaca, California, and the influence of indigenous communities from Oaxaca who have come to live and work in the Golden State and in L.A. Our guests are Javier Cabral, editor of L.A. Taco, husband and wife team Odilia Romero and Alfonso Martinez. She runs the nonprofit migrant group, the Binational Front of Indigenous Organizations in South L.A., and he operates the pop-up eatery Ponchos Tlayudas. L.A.'s food editor Elena Shatkin is also part of the conversation, and she started us off with this question about Oaxacan food.
I've also often heard of it sort of described as the mother cuisine of Mexico, you know, even though Mexico has so many different regions that have their own traditions. Would you say that's accurate?
The mother cuisine, I mean, it's because it's so indigenous forward in its techniques and elements. That's a fair, definitely a fair argument. We called it the soul food or the southern food of Mexico, because a lot of the food is richer. It's, I think, the only state in Oaxaca and Mexico that uses asiento. Asiento being when you make like a big vat of chicharrones or carnitas, pretty much all like the cracklings that boil down and like in the bottom of the pot. You scoop all that out and then you blend it up, and it's like this just wonder fat of like just toasted. Like a toasted chicharron paste that you spread on a clayuda.
It's super delicious.
Yeah, super delicious. And people in Oaxaca, they live to be very old eating this, right?
That gives me hope.
I mean, it's my favorite thing is asiento. And my family specializes in two things, which is pig and lamb. And that when they make the asiento and they're making the bioses, which is like the fat of the chicharron, and it's deep frying, the scent is so delicious that, I mean, you just go and snack them. If you have a mezcal, it's perfect, right? But a beer will do just perfectly fine. But it's the most delicious thing, and you could just grab a taco and a tortilla, put the asiento there, and just munch on it.
Yeah. And the word asiento, I remember when I was interviewing Maria de Jesus Monterrubio, who's like the matriarch of Galaguetza, the restaurant that the book is about. She, in her dialect, in her regional dialect of, I forgot what language it was, but in her regional dialect of Oaxaca, the asiento is so important that the word for a little child is all like asientito, like a little crispy skin. But it's delicious. Although I will say, in the book, we also have a recipe for vegan asiento. So FYI, we know.
You're covering all the bases.
It's 2019.
Well, just because I am me and I represent indigenous organizations, I have to say we are pushing for people to recognize our languages as languages and not dialect. So,
wow. Thank you for
good
that.
Good to know. So I'm curious now, as I mentioned before, there are a few main hubs of Oaxacan communities in Los Angeles, the big one being, that I know of mostly, Koreatown, but also one over on the west side, and you're in South LA, and I'm curious, when people from Oaxaca come here to, you know, settle in Los Angeles, is it people from certain regions tend to settle in Koreatown, whereas people from other regions settle in West LA, and maybe people from other parts of Oaxaca settle in South LA, or is it all a big mix?
No, there is a lot of what the academics call hometown associations. We are very well organized, and we replicate the way we live in Oaxaca here in LA. So in the case of my people, we first came to 6th and Union, those buildings, well, next to downtown. Mm-hmm. And we all were there at one point on 3rd and Rampart from the Sierra Norte.
That's in like basically the Pico Union neighborhood.
The Pico Union area.
Sure.
But after the legalization of 1986, not all of us, but the majority were able to buy houses, and they bought in South Central. I remember, like, when I got here, the first thing that they brought me was the cornflakes, the sugary ones.
Oh, Frosted Flakes?
Frosted Flakes. That was the most awful thing I had tasted.
That was a cereal my mom did not let me have often as a child.
Because I came from eating these big tortillas from the Sierra, from eating asiento, from eating pepitas, and suddenly they're like, oh, here, this is what we eat now. And then I'm like, oh, what is this? And I hated the food when I got here. Because it was so awful, because I grew up in the Sierra eating like grandma's food from a comal, right? And here it was just a terrible food.
It sounds like a lot of what you tried here when you first got here was very processed, too.
It's very processed. But also, that's a tradition that we have. So every time a new person comes, you bring them, you help them, you give them money to get an apartment, you help get them a job. And of course, you host them. Like at one point, there was 10 of us living in one apartment until they were ready to go. So we all kind of move in clusters. So we moved to South LA after 1986. I think it's every other house in South Central is owned by a Oaxacan.
Wow, I did not know that.
Being born as a Sogochense, it automatically makes me have these obligations with my community. If somebody dies, I have to give money. I have to give food. If there's a community event, I have to contribute somehow one way or another. It's like being part of who you are.
So a lot of people will go to a Oaxacan restaurant in any part of LA and just eat the food and be happy with that. What should they have in mind, though, as they're eating this food? Because this food has a story. So what would you say, ideally, when they're eating your food or food from a Oaxacan restaurant, they should have in mind, Alfonso?
I can't describe the food. I can't say you have to eat this or this. You have to have it in your hand. You taste it. It's hard for me.
Can you describe the blood sausage? Your blood sausage is kind of famous.
Minty.
Maybe you can describe it. Yeah.
It's minty. It's spicy. It's juicy. It's, oh my, you have to try it. Try it. You
it
have
is kind
to
of
try
famous.
It with the smorgasbord.
You have to
now.
Convince them. They probably will.
No, we serve many region, and I talk with Odilia and her family. I said we have to take our food in different place. We have our community, and the organizer from Smorgasburg came that week. Say, hey, Poncho, you want to go to Smorgasburg? I say, okay, where is it? What's that? So now, in Smorgasburg, every Sunday, our blood sausage, many people say, hey, I want a blood sausage because I saw you on Instagram. I hear your blood sausage on this radio station radio. I hear your blood sausage on LA Taco. Either LA.
Which
New
is
York
Miss
Times.
Hands.
Yes. They say, I already read about your blood sausage. I want to try it now. I say, okay, right here.
Oh, dear, yeah. What about you? The connection to the food and the people and the stories.
Well, I think when you're eating Oaxacan food, you're eating thousands of thousands of years of history. When you're eating a corn tortilla, you know, in my community, the tortilla has a heart. So when we were kids, they would say, you finish that tortilla or just grab the piece that you're going to eat because it has a soul. So if you throw it away, it's going to be sad. So think of that, like it's a being. Every time you eat a tortilla, think of it like it's a life thing. That's how we see it as indigenous people. Everything that we eat is a living thing. And also think of the hands of the were able to put it to the table. Think of those farm workers in Greenfield. Think of those farm workers that don't have access to the food that they produce. Think of that people and eat what you have to eat. In the case of Oaxacan food, I'm very picky. But I will tell you, every restaurant that you go to, they have amazing food. Every restaurant that I've gone to that are Oaxacan, I have my favorite dish in each one of them.
What's your favorite dish?
What are some of your favorite dishes?
For me, the barbacoa de borrego is my thing.
Lamb.
I go everywhere and I'll try it. And the blood sausage, I feel like, for me, that's nobody bakes it better than my family. My great-grandparents, because this is four generations now, they had some relation or they did something with the Spaniards to learn these recipes because this isn't a Mesoamerican dish. Mm-hmm. We added the chili, sure, but it is definitely ours now. And that I don't need it anywhere else unless my mom, Poncho, or my dad makes it. Can I tell you something? We don't eat tlayudas because I'm from up the Sierra.
Tlayudas. Interesting.
Not every Oaxacan eats tlayudas. That's the Triquis don't eat tlayudas. The Mixtecos don't eat tlayudas. The Chinantecos don't eat tlayudas. That is something that became something of Oaxaca, California that went back home.
So cuisine can really get that specific, not to the region, to, you know, different parts of, you know, Oaxaca. They don't necessarily eat the same traditional dishes.
No, the first time that we took blood sausage to the Guelaguetza in Fresno, nobody knew what we were selling. We had to give it away because in that region, they didn't eat that blood sausage that often, and they didn't know it was a tlayuda either.
Now, unfortunately, we're running out of time. Oh. Javier, real quick, for you, same question for you. You've got about a minute when it comes to what you should think about.
In recent food trends, there's been a trendy word that has been used and thrown around is decolonize your food, right? Decolonize pre-contact, if you're talking about like Hawaiian food or, you know, like going backwards in time and thinking what your grandparents would have eaten, you know, like eating less processed food. And comida oaxaqueña, by default, because that's the way it's been and that's the way it is and that's the way it will forever be. That's comida oaxaqueña, so enjoy it because it is what it is without being trendy or without being a buzzword.
Javier Cabral, Odilia Romero, and Alfonso Martinez, thanks for coming out.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was part of a conversation we produced back in October about the influence of Oaxacan culture and food in Southern California and elsewhere in the state. Our guests were Javier Cabral, editor of LA Taco and co-author of the new cookbook, Oaxaca, Home Cooking from the Heart of Mexico, LA's food editor, Elena Shatkin, plus husband and wife team, Odilia Romero and Alfonso Martinez. She runs the nonprofit migrant group, the Binational Front of Indigenous Organizations in South LA, and he operates the pop-up eatery Ponchos Tlayudas that you can also find on Sundays at the outdoor food market Smorgasbord just east of downtown. Next up, a story from our archives about Hollywood's oldest and most beloved steakhouse, Musso and Frank. Our trip through its past and its menu is coming up in about 3 minutes. Now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC, Emmy Martinez. Our next story is a special edition of Food Friday. It's exactly 100 years in the making. It starts with an entrepreneur named Frank Toulé, who back in 1919 opened a restaurant on Hollywood Boulevard called Frank's Cafe. Now, at the time, Hollywood was in its infancy. When the eatery opened its doors, there wasn't another restaurant for miles.
Hollywood Boulevard was a dirt road. I mean, literally a dirt road. There wasn't much around at all. There was some orange groves, a few avocado trees, and a couple studios.
That's Mark Echeverria, chief operating officer for the restaurant that Frank's Cafe would soon become. You see, in the early 1920s, Toulé partnered with a restaurateur named Joseph Musso, and their business venture soon took on a name that lives on today, Musso and Frank Grill. Soon it became a Hollywood hotspot. Anybody who was anybody could be seen at the restaurant.
And so Hollywood and Musso's really, truly did grow up together. And when you talk about history of one or the other, it's really symbiotic.
From stars of the silver screen like Fairbanks and Chaplin to greats of the written word such as Faulkner and Fitzgerald. Los Angeles was a land of transplants, much like it still is today, and the continental-style cuisine served up by Chef Jean Roux made diners feel at home. And it's Chef Roux who might also get credit for bringing Alfredo sauce. That's right, Alfredo sauce to America.
That story, it might be one of our most treasured stories of the restaurant.
Here's Mark Echeverria again.
Douglas Fairbanks and Mary Pickford. They got married and they went and honeymooned in Rome. And when they went to Rome, they went to Leonardo D'Aglio's restaurant, the originator of the fettuccine Alfredo. They went to his restaurant and they had the dish and they loved it. And they asked him for the recipe and he said no. So the next day, they go out in Rome and they find a gold spoon and a gold fork. And that night, they come back into the restaurant, they give it to him as a gift, and they say, can we have the recipe? And he gave it to them. Well, they brought the recipe back here. to Musso's.
It would take more than 90 years for the original recipe to make it to the menu, but it's there now. Musso and Frank's reputation as a friendly neighborhood hangout continues to this day. So, what's next for the Hollywood centenarian? Well, that's what we went to find out.
I'm here at Musso and Frank Grill with historical journalist Hadley Mears. Hello, Hadley.
Hello, thanks for having me.
And we're also with Mark Echevarria, Chief Operating Officer. Mark, thanks for having us out here.
Our pleasure. Thank you for coming.
I mean, this is a place where if you don't believe in time machines, you could actually step into Musso and Frank and just be in one, because it feels like we've just gone back 100 years.
Absolutely. That's kind of the feeling that we want everybody to have, that everyone's had for the last 100 years. And you know, I think Gore Vidal said it best when he said, stepping into Musso's is like stepping into a warm bath.
Hadley, what do you think of these red leather booths, the wood all over the place? I mean, it just feels like we're...
It feels so cozy, yeah. And I'd kind of like to just drink a lot of martinis and pass out in this booth right here, right now.
So, Mark, let me ask you this. Why do you think this place has just withstood the test of time? I mean, other places have come and gone, yet Musso and Frank continues to be going strong after 100 years.
One of the biggest reasons why we've been around for 100 years is that we've always stayed true to what we originally meant to do, which back in the early 20s, when the menu was first created, it was a menu that was created to sort of appease everybody from around the world, where Hollywood at that time, everybody was coming from different countries to be a part of this new kind of movie industry. And so it was this melting pot of cultures. And the original chef, Jean Roux, here really kind of created a menu to tailor to that. We still do that today. We're mainly steaks and chops, lots of Italian, lots of French. We've never really made a left turn to hit any of the culinary trends or anything like that. Our customers know they can come in here and get that consistent meal, something that they got 60 years ago. Some of our customers have been coming in for that long. And then they pass it down in their generations. And so the second and third generation of Musso customer expect the same thing that their grandfather got.
Musso and Frank Grill is celebrating 100 years, and I'm with historical journalist Hadley Mears and also Chief Operating Officer Mark Echevarria. You know, Mark, Orson Welles once said Musso and Frank was like being in the womb. And I imagine a big part of the praise was due to menu. And we've talked about the menu a bit, but I want to know, take us back to the original menu. What are some of the things that were on that menu then that are still on the menu today?
Sure. Chicken pot pie. We serve it every Thursday. That's a highlight for everybody. The grenadine of beef, the sand dabs, filet of sand dabs you really can't get anywhere but Musso's. We've got Welsh rarebit still on the menu. Lamb kidneys, which was Charlie Chaplin's favorite dish, is still on the menu. I know that kind of makes everybody go, huh? but it's one of those things that's like an homage to Charlie. You know, we got to keep it on the menu. And it actually gets ordered, believe it or not.
Those are the dishes he won when those horse races on Hollywood Boulevard, right?
Exactly.
Against Douglas Fairbanks.
Exactly. And the loser would have to buy his lamb kidneys.
Yeah. And he would be winning them most of the time,
He would be winning
Charlie
lamb
Chaplin,
kidneys.
Yeah.
Yep.
So this menu, along with the location, made it really a restaurant for the stars of the silver screen. And what I'm really interested in is literary stars that hung out here as well. The Samuel Rose Bookstore was next door. The Screenwriters Guild was across the street. Can you name drop for us a little? Who were some of the regulars here in that kind of heady 1930s, 40s time?
Absolutely. William Saroyan, F. Scott Fitzgerald, a little bit later, Hemingway, of course. All the literary giants really did come through the restaurant. And the restaurant started out as a writer's place before it really became sort of the actor-actress, you know, kind of a place. And you touched on it. The Screenwriters Guild was across the street. And so back then, a lot of the studios were hiring novelists to come out and write their screenwrites. And what a novelist thought should be up on the screen was a little bit different than what a studio exec thought should be up on the screen. And so the studio exec would redline, and you know, that would kind of hit the ego of the novelist, and maybe rightfully so, right? So they'd go to the Screenwriters Guild to complain, and then they'd come across the street and get drunk at Musso's.
Now, Mark, I'm glad that you said that all the writers came back here and got drunk, because I don't know of many writers that actually don't have a cocktail nearby when they're writing. Your cocktail menu here, your drink menu here at Musso and Frank, that's also almost as legendary as the food menu.
Absolutely, yeah. You got to stick with the classics. You know, the Manhattans, of course, the martinis, the old fashions. you can't stray away from that. You know, we're bartenders here. We listen. We use that kind of psychological element too. You know, we listen to what you have to say. Everyone's got a story. Everyone wants to tell their story, and they want to tell it with a great drink in front of them.
Okay, so we're about to dive into the menu, Mark. What do you suggest that we have?
For lunch, my go-to is the sand dabs. I love the sand dabs for lunch. It's served with a sauté meunière sauce, like a lemon butter caper sauce. Fantastic. If you want a steak, you can get steak too at lunch.
It's good to know.
Yeah, really, the whole menu is available at lunch.
And do you think that if we were doing this interview in 2119, that this place would look the same? The menu would look the same?
I mean,
that would be the point, right?
It absolutely would be the point, 1,000%. There is no ambition to change anything in this restaurant.
Well, Mark, thank you so much for making the time. We're about to eat some of your tasty food.
My pleasure, guys. Enjoy.
So I'm going to get the grilled lamb kidneys, since I've heard that was Charlie Chaplin's favorite.
It was.
So I'm going to do that.
And I'll take what Douglas Fairbanks and Mary Pickford had, the original fettuccine Alfredo.
Perfect. You're going all classic.
That's right.
All right, Helly, so you got a lot on your plate there. That's the lamb kidneys that's in front of you. Yep. You look terrified, but also thrilled at the same time.
I'm thrilled aesthetically, but my taste buds are terrified. I'm not sure what is about to happen here. So we have like the lamb kidneys and au jus with, they love bacon.
Mm-hmm.
Bacon on top.
God bless them.
Oh, my Lord. Okay.
Give it a shot.
I didn't know this was going to turn into like an extreme eating show. Okay. It tastes like a very dense hot dog.
Oh, okay.
With a creaminess.
Had you had lamb kidneys before?
No, I just did this because of Charlie Chaplin.
First time, all right, wow. Oh, because, there you go. Well, maybe he's getting the last laugh on you.
I think he maybe is. People had different tastes back then. It's really interesting.
So now I'm going to have a bit of the fettuccine Alfredo. This is the one that Douglas Fairbanks and Mary Pickford, the recipe they brought back from their honeymoon in Rome that the chef here made for them for a long time before they put it on the menu. It's about 7 years ago. So I'm going to give this a stick the fork in there, curl it up, and here we go.
Hmm. They told us that there's no cream in this.
Yeah.
And that the stock is water-based so that you can really taste the noodle. And they're right. You can really taste the noodle.
Oh, yum. Is it a fresh noodle?
Yeah, it's absolutely fresh.
Ooh.
Really good. Really good. And now we got the ribeye, too. The ribeye's right in front of our producer, Austin Cross.
Oh, yeah. I get to try this one.
I know. We've been trying our stuff first while your mouth salivates.
Yeah, here I have had to watch you guys have all the fun here. All right. Gonna carve into this little fatty corner. Thanks for holding my mic for me. Oh, look at that. It's red on the inside.
Oh, they made it perfect, too. Nice and medium
so
rare.
Juicy. All right, here we go. Wow.
Yeah.
That is a steak.
That's hard
steak
to
really
pass up.
Yeah. I can see how that stuck around 100 years. Oh, man. I'm about to have more of this. Hold your own mic, eh?
Well, I definitely feel like we had the full Musso and Frank experience. 100 years young and still churning out a mean steak. Hadley Mears is a historical journalist. Hadley, thanks for coming along on our culinary walk down memory lane.
Thank you. I've got my mouth full with just a delicious steak. But thank you for having me. This was a lot of fun.
Have a banana, Hannah. Try the salami, Tommy.
Next up, there are roughly 400 soul food eateries in L.A. In 1 minute, we go check out one with a true California twist. Keep your ears here.
Here's Cacciatore Dore. Taste of bologna, Tony. Everybody eats when they come to my house. I fix your favorite dishes. Hoping this good food fills ya. Work my hands to the bone in the kitchen alone. You better eat if it kills you. Pass me a pancake mandrake. Having a derby irvy. Look in the fendel mendel. Everybody eats when they come to my house. Hannah, Davy, Tommy.
Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. All right, let's talk about soul food. A quick web search turns up no less than 400 results in L.A. alone. Now, with so many choices, it might be hard to know where to go, so writer Jay Connor did the hard work for you. He penned the article, Where to Eat Soul Food in L.A. right now for our website, LAist.com. So, for this Food Friday, we pull from the archives our interview with him from earlier in the year. That day, Jay and I took a trip out to the restaurant My Two Cents on Pico in Mid-City to get a taste of some SoCal soul.
Can I tell you what jumps out at me right off the bat? Oxtail tacos.
Yes.
You were smiling as I was saying it, so you had to know that that was going to get my attention. Why is this such an attention grabber?
Primarily just because it's a fusion of different types of cuisine. You know what I mean? Traditionally, oxtail you associate with, you know, soul food and things of that nature, and tacos, obviously Mexican. So I think that's probably why it caught your eye.
You mentioned, Jay, how it fuses different types of cuisine. Is that essential? Is that the kind of the roots of soul food?
I would say so, I mean, you know, when it comes to soul food specifically, it's a hybrid, a synthesis of European, indigenous, and African cuisine. And as far as the history of it, it's rooted in the inhumane rations that the enslaved people were given. From that, you had the undesirable parts of pigs, which meant that they were eating ham hocks, which meant they were eating neck bones, which meant that they were eating chitlins. You have ingredients like okra. You have ingredients such as rice. And greens that came over as a byproduct of the transatlantic slave trade. So when you combine all that stuff, and then you look at the fact that they had to cook this stuff in a manner in that they were able to get the calories necessary to survive the inhumane treatment that they dealt with as a result of being enslaved. So, yeah, it's definitely a synthesis of all these different things.
Now, when it comes to my two cents, why did this place make your list?
It's just great. I mean, if you ask anybody, excluding myself, if you ask anybody, like, hey, what's one of the best places out here? My two cents is always going to come up, and especially because there's always a chance you'll run into a celebrity here, too, as well.
All right, Jay, we have a much more important person sitting next to you, so we're going to leave you aside for a second. Chef Elisa, also owner of My Two Cents. First of all, thank you for having us out here.
Thank you. Welcome.
Now, this particular place, why did you choose this place right here on Pico to have your restaurant?
I'm a native of L.A., and this was a sweet spot when I was a kid. Plus, it had cheap rent in 2013, so that's what I was looking for.
Cheap rent. Well, that, you know, that's everyone loves cheap rent, especially in Los Angeles. Did you feel that maybe this area needed a soul food restaurant or another soul food restaurant?
Not necessarily. Well, I don't consider my food straight down the middle soul food. So did I think that this restaurant needed to happen somewhere in L.A.? Yes, because a lot of soul food doesn't have the take on it that I put on it, such as the gluten-free options, the vegan options in terms of, say, black IPs. Most black IPs come with meat in them. Most of the traditional elements of the vegetables I found had some type of meat in them. So that element, as well as just making a place where everybody can go. I wanted it to be in a place where it was easy to get to from the north side, the south side, the west side. So it was a good area in terms of the middle of the road.
When you mentioned that you didn't want to go traditional necessarily with soul food, and for people of color, diabetes, weight issues are
all of that.
Was that one of the reasons why you structured your menu the way you structured it? 100%.
I'm classically French trained. I made French food most of my career. And I just wanted to do something that was progressive in the area of American comfort food.
You mentioned like things like oxtail tacos.
Right.
A fusion of different cultures in a way. How much did that go into what you got going on?
Well, exactly. So being from LA, we have a lot of different cultures, obviously. So, and we're a taco crazed city. So I wanted to make a taco that, it was actually between this and Frog Leg Tacos. I had made them both and I decided on oxtail.
All right, so what do you suggest we try? I mean, we looked at the menu. We almost want to try everything, but
well,
I mean,
that's what people
narrow
say.
It down for us.
People always say, well, what should we try? And I said, well, you should work your way from the top to the bottom.
Top to the bottom.
The first visit usually takes 3 days.
3 days. Well, but, I mean, the oxtail tacos got my eye the second
to.
I saw it.
Yeah, we braise that for 9 hours until it falls off the bone. Rub it with rosemary, our special seasoning that we have, and fresh garlic, beer, Guinness, and orange juice.
So I'm trying the oxtail tacos. That's my choice.
I would
your
say
choice.
The shrimp and grits, because that is one of our most popular. If you Google it, apparently we have the best shrimp and grits in L.A. So.
All right. I think we've got we're set up. Chef, thank you very much for having us out. I think we're going to start trying stuff.
Get in here. Let's go.
Wait, what is this right here?
It's a turkey meatloaf burger.
Turkey meatloaf burger.
Mm-hmm. And then this is shrimp and grits.
We about to get our life.
Grits.
Together.
Thank you.
All right.
We about to get our life.
All right, so Jay, so what we have in front of us, crispy turkey meatloaf burger. This was a surprise item. Fresh house-made meatloaf, Japanese breadcrumb, shaved apples, red cabbage, slaw. It looks amazing. Texas toast to go on top
Texas
of it.
Texas toast.
So let's...
Anything that's in between Texas toast, you know it's going to be banging.
I know. So let's give it a shot. Let's give it a try here.
That is perfectly balanced. Wow. Crispy, flavorful, juicy all the way through.
Absolutely. And it's light.
Yeah.
Sometimes sandwiches suffer from the not the right bread for the sandwich syndrome. That is not the case with this thing. Mm-hmm. You mentioned how light it is. Part of it has to do with the bread is not overpowering the sandwich.
And it's got that crunch to it because of that Texas toast. No. If this was in like a regular bun, it wouldn't be the same.
No. We're at My Two Cents here on Pico Boulevard, right in the middle of LA. We just had the crispy turkey meatloaf burger. Now, Jay, what are we going to have next?
Next, we're having the succulent shrimp and grits. My favorite thing here.
Your favorite thing here. Okay.
My favorite thing here.
All right.
Just although I don't know that meatloaf burger.
I know. And you might have to revise your list, Jay, right? In just a moment.
Yes, sir. This isn't a meal. This is a spiritual experience. That's what this is. You look like you just caught the Holy Ghost.
Well, no, yeah, because think about, okay. So for people that maybe aren't seafood people.
Yeah.
And that think, well, shrimp is hit or miss. I don't know how possibly this could be a miss. Again, like just like with the sandwich, there's a ton of balance between the shrimp and the liquid. I mean, it's like it's perfectly placed. Every item perfectly placed. And then when it's all together, it's perfectly placed.
It's amazing.
It's amazing.
Yeah, wow. It's light. It's fresh. It's filling.
You said that twice, too, light. And that's exactly what's going on. And that's chef's idea, right, for this menu, is to be as light as possible so that you don't feel like you're loaded down and heavy.
That's the biggest thing, because usually when you eat soul food, you're knocked out for the rest of the day. You're done. Yeah. You know, you need a good 3-4 hours just to digest. But after you eat this, I feel like I go shoot some hoops or something like that.
This is fuel for the body, soul, the mind, everything.
Yes, yes.
Wow.
A little bit of Parmesan.
Everything. Wow. All right, Jay, now to the item that caught both of our attention, and you've never tried these, right? The oxtail tacos.
Yeah.
All right, so according to the description, and Chef even mentioned it, six-hour braised kosher natural oxtail, shredded kale, for all the public radio listeners out there, that's kale, it's a religion, roasted tomato, whiskey reduction.
Correct.
All right. I had to close my eyes because that's what it does to you. Two things combined to make one great thing.
You know how they say that the meat falls off the bone?
Yep.
I felt like the meat fell off my tongue. It's just so succulent. Like, it's just like, oh, man. And it's so flavorful, even with the kale on it. Because generally people are kind of, you think kale and, like, oxtail, like, that's a weird combination. But
and I'm so glad lettuce isn't on this.
Yeah.
It makes a big difference to have the kale on it.
Absolutely.
Plain old lettuce.
Absolutely.
Wow. Okay,
well,
Chef. Okay.
Tell me.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Right?
We knew this
I'll start paying myself now.
We knew this was soul food, Chef, but you didn't say it would be soul changing and soul altering.
Right. Well, it will change your life.
Wow.
I've heard everything from foodgasmic to just pure on insanity.
So let's just say someone's listening to this and is interested. They're still worried. You know, it's still maybe they've never had soul food and they don't know, you know, what to expect.
Right.
What's the one thing you would tell someone to be adventurous and to come out here and try it?
I would say open your mind. It's closer to your heart than you think.
Chef, thank you very much for having us
out here. Thank you, guys. Come back, please.
Jay Conner wrote about this restaurant and a lot of other great soul food restaurants in L.A. on our website, laist.com. That's laist.com. Jay, thanks for showing us this place and having us out here with you.
It was a pleasure to indulge and share my appetite with you as well.
Watch me! I got soul, and I'm super bad.
Jay Conner and I ate a whole lot more than just what you heard there. I'm talking cornbread with honey, peach cobbler, something called crazy cake. Man, oh man. Well, all right, Jay wrote about it, but we want to hear from you. What's your favorite soul food spot in SoCal? Tweet us. We're at Take Two. That's at Take Two. Sometimes I feel so nice. I want to try myself a few. Well, that's it for Take Two this week. Thanks for choosing us to spend your time with. Now, if you enjoyed all the talk about food, tune in every Friday to hear more about the wonderful dishes you can find in Southern California, from Vietnamese pho to Russian blintzes to traditional Filipino lumpia, and also to a great basic burger as well. Coming up this month, we'll talk tamales, vegan ones too, latkes, the crazy story of how San Fernando Valley car washes became culinary hotbed for hot chicken sandwiches. All these stories also up on our website, laist.com. Lastly, since this week is one to give thanks, we want to give a big shout out to the Take Two team. Our producers are Lori Skywalker-Galaretta, Austin Cross, and Leo Duran. Leo Orlori directed the show this week. Austin was our showrunner. Ari Saperstein and Caroline Champlin helped us out with production. Tamika Adams is our news apprentice. The program is engineered by Hazmik Pogosian. Senior producer is Megan Larson. And I'm A. Martinez. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram, same address, at A. Martinez LA. Talk to everyone next week.